Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 195. I'm recording it on Tuesday, December 29th, 2009. The P10 level today is 20. That's on the high side. Stocks offer a dubious value proposition at today's prices and in today's market environment. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of the selection is Lacane. The title of the podcast is Risk. I've wanted to have a title like that ever since. I think I mentioned in an earlier podcast some months back, but I always liked the Beatles single titled Help, because it's cool, because it's one syllable, nice and short. It's got an exclamation point at the end, so it's just got a lot of punch. Nice and short, exclamation point. And I thought when I said that, I thought, boy, wouldn't it be great to do a investing podcast like that. One syllable title, exclamation point at the end. And the way to do it is to focus on the key issue of investing, which is risk. That's what it's all about. I think all the time, the material I provide at PassionSaving.com is not aimed at the sophisticated investor. It's aimed at the everyday person who is investing his or her money to provide for an old age retirement, or an early retirement for that matter. And a lot of these people are intimidated about investing. It's a big problem. They feel they have to go to the experts. They have to go to the stock selling industry to find out how to invest in stocks. And that's the last place you want to go. The stock selling industry might be just a wee bit biased in favor of stocks, do you think? They might just be a wee bit biased. They make hundreds of millions of dollars if you buy stocks, if you go with stocks regardless of price, but they'll be kicked out on the street. They'll lose their jobs if they happen to tell you the straight story. A wee bit biased, I think. Maybe. Let's not say for sure. I just have a hunch. I just got a funny feeling. I don't know. We'll see. So that's not the thing to do. But a lot of people, they're intimidated. They don't want to do the research on their own. They don't feel they can do it. And the stock selling industry, of course, uses a lot of big words to intimidate. You know, you got to understand Sharpe ratio. You don't know anything about stock. You don't know Sharpe ratio. You know, nothing wrong with Sharpe ratio, but you don't need to know anything about it. I don't know anything about it as a deliberate policy. I don't want to know anything about it. I don't want to turn into a buy and hold advocate. I want to talk sense. I want to think logically and clearly. And I don't need to look at all this gibberish. This is a side note, but my friend William Bernstein, he was quoted at Bogleheads, and this just drives me up a wall. Good guy. William Bernstein's a smart guy. Chapter 2 of his book, The Four Pillars of Investing, is the best chapter I've ever read of any investing guide. And he mentioned this in that book, and he's got this theme, and he says, I don't think most, he's sad about it. And he says, I don't think most middle-class people are able to invest effectively. He's basically saying they're not smart enough. They don't know enough mathematics. If he puts mathematical equations in his book, they won't read them. You know, this is what, he says, 2% are capable of doing it. And he says the rest really need to go to advisors. And I don't agree. I have nothing against going to advisors. I think that can make sense in the right circumstances. It's good to have somebody to bounce ideas off of. I don't think it's a requirement. But I don't think most people are dumb either. I talk to people. I go to my boys. My boys are in Little League. I go to Little League games. You talk to people. They sure understand baseball strategies. Is stock investing any harder than baseball? No. Roughly the same. There's a couple rules you need to know. You need to know how many balls there are before you get a walk and how many strikes. You know, you need to know the basic facts. How many outs in an inning? You know, what are the nine positions? And if you get the basics, all the rest, it's, you know, you're going to see a freak play every now and then. You're not going to know what the answer is. You have to look up the rule book. Doesn't happen that often. It's not a big deal. But the biggest problem you've got is you got to tune out the gibberish put upon you by the stock selling industry, the so-called experts in the field, because the quote-unquote experts are trying to sell you stocks, okay? They're not giving it to you straight. And if all you ever hear is the buy stocks for the long run, buy and hold, stay the course, timing doesn't work, hey, you're not going to know what you're doing. And I'm getting worked up. Yeah, tune that stuff out. I only wish we lived in a world where I could record these podcasts and nobody had ever heard anything from the stock selling industry. And I think I could record one podcast and it would be 45 minutes long and it would tell you everything you need to know to be an effective stock, far more effective stock investor than you'll ever be listening to the quote-unquote experts. And that'd be all I'd have to record. Instead of recording 195 of them, the job would be done. But I've got to record 195 because there's so much gibberish out there. But it's all about risk. And, of course, that's what baseball's about. You know, I mean, obviously, you got to have skill. You know, you got to have, you got to know how to hit the ball. And you got to know how to pitch the ball. But in investing, you don't really have to do that because the companies do all the execution. All you have to do is figure out the strategy part. You're sort of like the manager of the team. You don't have to bat the ball or pitch the ball or catch the ball. All you need to do is, like, you're the manager, you know. That's what investing is like. And the manager's got to think about risk. He's got to say, well, I leave that pitcher in. He's a good pitcher, but he's getting a little tired. He's the best pitcher I've got, but he's tired. And, you know, if I leave him in one more batter and they hit a home run, we're cooked. But if I take him out, you know, he's coming up next inning and I'll have to use a pinch hitter and waste another pitcher. And, you know, he's got to weigh pros and cons. And that's what you got to do to invest. And so risk is what it's all about. Now, I've recorded several podcasts about risk. It's a theme I return to. There was one, a fairly recent one, was called Risk is Never, Never, Never Good. Never, never, never good. I think I said it three times. Risk is never, never, never good. And that, again, came from a Bill Bernstein line. Bill Bernstein had some line. Oh, you know, I think he started out his new book. I think it's called The Investor's Manifesto. And he said, you know, if you want to get high returns, you got to take on more risk. He says, there's just no other way to do it. And I had a guy come to my blog, Evidence-Based Investing. And he says, oh, Rob, you know, Bernstein's right. I mean, and you got to take risk. And I'm, no, 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 no. It's crazy talk. No offense intended. I love Bill Bernstein. I respect his intellect. But it's crazy talk. There's, of course, a surface logic there. You can't, you know, you've got to be willing to take on some risk in this life. Yes, yes, that part makes sense. So, yes, you can't just be a scared little, you know, nervous Nelly in the corner and never take on any risk and expect to get a good return. But if you really buy into what he was saying, that return, he's saying return is correlated with risk. If return is always correlated with risk, well, you want high returns, right? So the logical follow-up or the logical consequence is risk is good. Risk is how you get higher returns. And so now what are you doing? You're trying to invest in a risky way. Could anything be more insane? Do you do that in any other area of your life? Do you deliberately take on risk? Do you drive your car at, you know, 120 miles an hour drunk just because you say, oh, you know, risk is somehow good? Risk isn't good. You want to avoid risk. So that podcast argued that point. Risk is never, never, never good. You know, yes, you know, there's this sense in which return is good. So you have to be willing to take on some risk. But you want to be avoiding risk. The whole idea of investing is to avoid risk. That's common sense investing. That's rational investing. That's what we argue for at PassionSaving.com. We never tell you risk is good. You want to limit your risk. You have to take on some risk because that's just life. But you don't want to deliberately take on risk. Buy and hold, that's risky. That's risky investing. That's as risky as it gets. in my opinion, Rob Bennett's opinion. But that's crazy. Deliberate risk you don't have to take on. Another one was called risk tolerance in the real world. And the buy and holders always talk about risk tolerance. And that's a real phenomenon. Different people have different risk tolerance. But I tried to point out in that podcast that in the real world, it doesn't work quite the way they say. That most of the risk isn't with the individual. They want to put you on a psychiatric couch and say, how much risk tolerance do you have? And you'll have to go with a 60% stock allocation rather than a 70% because you have a higher risk tolerance. According to our Freudian analysis of we asked you these questions and you told us answers. Who the heck knows what your risk tolerance is? It's okay to look at your risk tolerance, but it's the big thing is the risk of the asset class. In other words, you buy stocks when they're overpriced. Sure, they're risky as all get out. Buy stocks at the prices that applied from 1996 and through 2008. Yeah, that's risk all right. You don't need to check your risk tolerance. It's higher than anybody alive should be taking on a high stock allocation at those prices. So you don't need to be psychoanalyzing yourself. And then there was another one called risk without risk. And that's the beauty of valuation-informed indexing. I distinguished in that podcast between perceived risk and actual risk. And what you want to do is take on perceived risk, because if you take on perceived risk, you will be compensated for that. You will be compensated. So you'll do well. But you don't want to take on actual risk, because then you'll actually lose money, and that's not what you want. So you want to take on risk without taking on risk. So I called that one risk without risk. So I like to explore the risk issue. And this is at least a fourth one doing it directly, but a lot of them do it indirectly. And I needed a new title, and I thought about John Lennon and the Beatles, and I said, hell, he did help, and I liked it, and so this one's called Risk. And it's about the core subject of investing, risk. Now, the other theme that I've been exploring a lot lately is volatility. And this one, I considered giving this a volatility title. I have one called Volatility is Like Pollution. And I have one called, I think that one's not up. I think that's the one I had technical troubles with. And I have one called Volatility is Optional, which I think is our most important insight of all, the first 7 years of discussions. I had one called Volatility Adds Nothing. And I had one called Volatility is Evil, trying to organize a groundswell to eliminate volatility in the stock market, which I think can be done. You'll have to listen to that podcast to hear that argument, but I think volatility is optional in the stock market. That's what I believe. But it's there today. It's a reality today, so we need to know how to deal with it. But there's a thing that has troubled me, and what often happens, I'll bet you've had this experience, you puzzle over things during the day, you go to sleep, you wake up with the answer on your tongue. And that's happened to me 100 times during the first 7 years of our discussions in the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities. What often happens is I'll wake up with the answer on my tongue, and I go downstairs, I scribble in a notebook, and if I have time, I record a podcast on it that day, and a lot of them have come from that. And if I don't have time, it goes into the notebook, and I maybe pull it out maybe later, or else I just forget about it and I never get to it. That happens with a lot of them too. Some of them aren't worth, if they're not compelling enough to record, maybe they're not important enough either. But there's this question. If you listen to the buy and holders, John Bogle's the lead advocate, and you listen to Warren Buffett, Bogle and Buffett are probably the two most famous investing experts alive today. They have a very different definition of risk, and I think that's so strange. Whenever you're trying to learn a subject, you have to start with the beginning. It's a very good place to start, and then proceed and learn things and build on the foundation. And if you start in confusion, you're going to end up in confusion. And it sure seems to me that if we're going to claim that we know what we're talking about on investing, that we ought to have some agreement on what risk is. We're all trying to avoid risk or take on risk or whatever it is we're trying to do. We all ought to know what it is, at least. If we don't know what it is, we've got a problem. And there's a big disagreement. The buy and hold people, they believe in this efficient market theory. It's all mumbo jumbo, truth be told. But there's important insights in there mixed in, and that's what I try to sort out, the good stuff from the junk. But they say risk is volatility. In other words, risk is the reason they say stocks are risky. You know, Bernstein would say you can't get higher returns without higher risk. And stocks, you get higher returns, so they must be more risky. And that would say, well, how do you know they're risky? Well, because the price jumps around a lot. Volatility is risk. And Warren Buffett says, that's nuts, man. And he ought to know. But he says, that's nuts. And he's got a darn strong argument. He says, okay. He says, say that I have two stocks that I own, and I pay $10 for both of them, and one of them stays at $10 for 10 years, and the other one goes from $10 to $30 over 10 years, which is the more risky? And they say, oh, well, the volatility is higher on the second one. It went from 10 to 30. That's a lot of volatility. Very, very risky. Oh, very risky stock. He's like, risky? What's the risk? I tripled my money. What kind of risk is that? I wish I could have more risk like that. And he's right. Risk, according to Buffett, risk is losing money. That's risk. And that's a much more common sense definition. Risk is losing money. Volatility is not risk. Volatility is volatility. Risk is losing money. Well, that's what I agree with. But when I went over that in one of those earlier podcasts, I said, while I agree with Buffett, I do have a little bit of sympathy for the argument being made by the buy and holders, the passive investing advocates. And I couldn't articulate it very well. And that's what I woke up understanding about, I don't know, a week ago or so. And I said, there's a sense in which risk can be volatility. And let me just start with that. The purpose of this podcast is to sort of address these definitional issues, what risk is. Just sort of a podcast on what is risk, because you have to know what risk is in order to understand lots of things about investing. And what I came up with is, I have another podcast. I'm referring to a lot of old podcasts today, all my old friends. There's a podcast entitled Indexing Changes Everything. And the point there is that I believe that Bogle is wrong about buy and hold, but I think he's very, very right about indexing. And I think he started a revolution in investing. He opened the door to a wonderful new way for middle-class investors to invest. So John Bogle's a hero of mine. None of the material at my site would be possible without Bogle's contribution, and Buffett's, and Shiller's, and lots of other people. But Bogle is a hero in my eyes. And one of the things, of course, what he did was he brought in indexing. He started the indexing revolution. And I argued in this podcast, indexing changes everything. In other words, all the rules of investing. One of the reasons we're in such a confused state today is the things that had become received wisdom in the pre-indexing era don't always make sense in an indexing environment. And so we need to revisit all these rules. And a lot of people have a hard time doing that. They just, you know, there's inertia is the most powerful force on planet Earth, I sometimes think. People just, you can offer people, you know, a way to make $1 million, and they'll just say, well, nobody's ever done it before. I don't know. I mean, I just got to walk down the street and pick up $1 million. Well, I don't know. It sounds kind of risky. I don't know. Like, all you got to do is walk down the street and pick it up. What's the problem? But inertia. So there is a sense in which Buffett's definition of risk makes sense in the context in which Buffett invests, and Buffett follows a strategy called value investing. And there's a sense in which the Bogle definition of risk makes sense in the context in which Bogle invests in indexes. And here it is. I think this is important. This distinction. Buffett is trying to, what he does is he, of course, picks individual stocks. He doesn't engage in indexing. So he's picking a stock, and of course, he's applying his intelligence to do that. He's researching the stock and talking to the managers or the executives or whatever it is, and, you know, seeing if it has a moat around it, seeing what the competition is. So he forms an intellectual judgment that a company is worth $10 a share and it's selling for $5 a share. And so his brain tells him, well, if I'm buying something worth $10 and it's selling for $5, the odds are good that I'm going to make money. And not certain. Might go down and only be worth $2, you know. But the odds are it's going to end up being worth $10, and I'm only paying $5. So if the odds on bet comes through, I'm going to make double my money. So that's a good bet. Whereas if the company is worth $5 and selling for $10, that's a bad bet. So I avoid the bad bets and go with the good bets, and I'm not going to get everyone right, but I'm going to get more right than wrong, and I'm going to end up in a good spot. That's value investing. Now, say you're a value investor, you buy the company for $5, and you think it's worth $10, and it shoots up to $10, and that's volatility. That's high volatility. Say it does that in 1 year. It doubles in 1 year. That's high, high volatility. Is that good or bad? Well, it's obviously good, because the company, it's doing just what you anticipated with all your research. So it's confirming your judgment. You formed a judgment based on the use of intellect, and the real world has now confirmed your judgment. So what could be better? It's all good news. There's no bad news there. So this is why, to Buffett, the idea that volatility is risk seems nutty. Now compare that to the indexing situation, the Bogle investor. When you buy an index fund, you're not trying to apply your intellect to the investing process. It's not that you're stupid and you can't do it. You're not even trying to do it. I mean, maybe because you're stupid, you're not trying, but not always. A lot of indexers are very smart people. They just elect not to. They say, I'm not going to bother with any of that picking stock stuff and applying intellect stuff. I'm just going to buy the market. Now, so they're letting the market make the decisions. And of course, there's a judgment involved, but it's a very simple judgment. The simple judgment is the U.S. market has always, through history, provided a long-term return of something in the neighborhood of 6.5 real, and the judgment is that's probably going to stay more or less true. So maybe it'll be 6, maybe it'll be 7. It's going to be something in that neighborhood. So I'm not trying to use my intellect. I'm not trying to make a good pick. Now, say that investor buys the index and sees a doubling over the course of a year in what he paid. Is that that's not a good thing? Not really. Now, it might be that investor's jumping up and down. He's happy that he doubled his money, but he shouldn't be. Now, why shouldn't he be? Because he is not relying on an increase in price to make his investment worthwhile. What he's really relying on is that the market sort things out. He's sort of once removed from the investing process. He's buying the market. He's not buying an individual stock. So for his judgment that stocks are going to provide 6.5 a year to be confirmed, which is what you want. You want to know that you did the right thing. For his judgment to be confirmed, what he wants to see is a 6.5% gain. Not a doubling, not a 100% gain. A 100% gain tells him that something is fishy, something's wrong. Either his judgment is totally bonkers and he has no idea what he's doing because he was only anticipating 6.5, or the 100% gain comes from excessive, you know, an insane level of overvaluation, in which case returns in the future are, of course, going to be minuscule. In other words, he's getting 100% return this year, but, you know, then he's going to have a 50% loss next year. So what good is it? So see the difference? To the Buffett investor, the value investor, 100% gain is all good, no bad. Very exciting stuff. And confirms his judgment. To the Bogle investor, the indexing investor, a 100% gain is really a bad thing. He might be excited about it, but if he's excited, he's foolish to be so, because what's happening is that his judgment is not being confirmed. Things are not happening as he anticipated, which indicates that he made a mistake. So in that sense, indexing is very different from picking individual stocks, and I think it can truly be argued that there is a sense in which volatility is risk for an indexer. I still don't go along with that. I still say that Buffett's understanding that risk is loss is the more common sense way to go and the better definition. However, I do think that you have to think about indexing a little differently than you think about stock picking. And I believe, you know, as a valuation-informed indexer, what I say is that we should all be looking for a gain each year of 6.5. And when the gain is more than that, we should be thinking about lowering our allocation a little bit, because that means the market is overvalued. If our judgment was correct, that the U.S. market is going to continue to provide roughly the same return it has always provided in the past, 6.5, then anything above 6.5 should undercut our confidence, make us a little nervous. And that should make us lower our allocation a little bit. So anything more than 6.5 is a bad sign, and it's the same way, I think, going down. Going down, if stocks go up less than 6.5, say they only go up 2% instead of 6.5, they're not meeting our judgment. They're not meeting the long-term average. And that suggests undervaluation. That suggests that future returns are going to be a little higher, which is nice, but it means the amount in our portfolio is a little less. But that's not really what we want. Some people will say that to me. They'll say, well, Rob, stocks today, the P10 level today is 20. That's the fair value P10 is 14. 20 is not as dangerous as what we had before the crash. From January 96 through September 2008, we're at insanely high prices. P10 levels above 25. That's where you're insane. We're not insane, but we're high. 20 is high. It's sort of the warning track. And people will say, well, you know, you're waiting, you know, you would prefer to invest heavily in stocks. Maybe you've got a 30% allocation now, but you're thinking, you know, if it goes down, you know, to fair value, you might want to go to 60 or something. And then if it goes down under 10, under a P10 level of 10, you might want to go to 70 or 80 or 90. And wouldn't you like to get if you go to the stock return predictor at the site, it'll tell you the most likely 10-year return, if we get down to a P10 level of 8, is 15% real per year for 10 years running. Wouldn't you like to see that, Rob? You can get rich. And the answer is no. I would like, certainly if we go to 7 or 8, I think it makes all the sense in the world to go to a high stock allocation, 80 or 90%. Certainly. You know, you can make a fortune. But if you ask me, do I really like the idea? The answer is no. I would prefer that we would go somewhere around 14 and stabilize. I think we had a great chance last fall. We went down to, well, in March, we were down to 12. And if we had more responsible people in the stock selling industry, they would have come forward. And instead of saying, don't worry, they would have came forward and said, let's start talking about the realities of stock investing instead of this buy and hold gibberish. And had they done that, we could have stabilized at 12, I believe. We needed our political and economic leaders to act responsibly. And we could have stabilized at 12. Instead, we've made a bad situation worse by pumping prices back up. We've now almost ensured that there's going to be another crash. And the next crash is going to really undermine middle-class confidence in our economic and political system. So I think it's a disaster. But I don't want to go down to 7. Why? Because if we go down to 7... that's almost a two-thirds drop from 20. If we do that, the odds are high that we're going into the second Great Depression. That's the situation we're in today, where if we just go to the PE10 levels that have always applied in the wake of insane valuation levels, if all we do is repeat what's always happened in the past, every time in the historical record, if that's all we do, we're going to be in the second Great Depression. That's the pickle we've put ourselves in with this crazy buy and hold talk. So no, I don't really like going below 14. I recognize that it happens, and if it happens, I feel it makes all the sense in the world to go with a high stock allocation. But I'd prefer, you know, 13, 14, 15 as the P10 level. And even there, a high stock allocation makes sense, but not quite as high. You know, maybe 60%, 70%. Depends on your, you know, here's where it depends on your risk tolerance. But so I really do believe that volatility is just a bad thing in any direction. The best thing in a rational market, the market price would reflect the discounted value of future earnings. And the discounted value of future earnings doesn't change with little jumps up and down in the economy. So the market would always be returning roughly 6.5 real per year. And the P10 level would always be roughly 14 or 15 every year. And volatility would essentially disappear, which would essentially mean risk would disappear. In other words, you could buy stocks, you could get that 6.5 return, and that'd be fine. And there would be no risk, and there'd be no volatility, and you would still get the same return. So that's where you really get risk without risk. We could all get risk without risk, but we would all have to educate each other. We'd have to open up the internet to honest posting on investing so that when prices went up, we would let people know, look, yeah, the price is up, your portfolio value's up temporarily, but look how much the long-term return has dropped. Look at the price you're paying. Look at the price we're all paying by this craziness. And if we informed people about that, we would all be inclined to sell stocks when prices got too high, and then the market would self-regulate. We wouldn't have a problem where the market would set these crazy prices. In other words, open up the internet to honest posting on investing, and the market will take care of the rest. Let the market work. That should be our motto. Let the market work. Right now, the market can't function because the stock selling industry doesn't want middle-class investors to learn the realities of stock investing. So you have people like Scott Burns telling me, Rob, it's catastrophically unproductive for you to tell people the real numbers. Catastrophically unproductive. Why is it catastrophically unproductive? I think it's catastrophically unproductive because the whole buy and hold model collapses to the ground if people learn the realities. That's why it's catastrophically unproductive. I think it's catastrophically productive to learn the realities. We can move from the buy and hold model to the rational model. We can all become more effective investors. We can all retire 5 years sooner. So there's a sense in which that's one sense in which volatility really is risk. Now, as I say, I don't really go for that. But as I was puzzling over that and sort of writing down some notes about, you know, for the podcast, I said, well, I don't go for it 100%, but I do think there's an argument there. And then I thought, well, you know, what's really going on here is that risk is not one thing. We use the word risk, and we all know, you know, what it means. I mean, everybody knows what the word risk means, but we have different meanings. It doesn't mean just one thing. You know, risk has different meanings. So I scribbled down some different meanings, and I just want to list them, just for the thought of as a mental exercise, a thought experiment, just to, you know, think these things over. Now, one distinction. So I made, I think there are eight of these. Are there eight or seven? I guess there are seven. Seven, well, maybe eight. I don't know. I can't count. I have eight. You're lucky you don't have to read my handwriting, dear listener. But there are eight sets of, adjectives, and I sort of contrast them. And I have an example from the non-investing world and an example from the investing world. But the first contrast I had was reasonable understanding of risk versus a fantasy understanding of risk. And it's an important distinction, you know? I mean, risk is the bedrock of your investing philosophy. If you build the whole investing philosophy on a fantasy, you're obviously going to get into trouble. Now, The thing I have listed from the real world, where I talk about the non-investing world, where I talk about a reasonable approach to risk is, say you're making a decision, you know, should I join the army or not, you know? And you say, well, you know, you're thinking it through and you're saying, well, I could get killed, you know? That's the downside of being in the army. They send me to Iraq and I get killed, you know? On the other hand, I might not get killed. A lot of people don't. Most people don't. And if I don't get killed, you know, the Army's got a pretty darn good pension. I know some people have been in the Army. They put in, whatever, 25 years. So they're out, you know, at 55. Pretty good deal. You say, you know, that's what I'd call a reasonable approach to risk assessment. You say, well, there's a downside. The downside is real. And I'm not going to deny it. I might get killed. But I might not. And the odds are I won't. And there's an upside. And so, now, you might take on that risk and you might get killed. In other words, just because you make a calculated decision to take on the risk, and it's a reasoned decision, it's an informed decision, it's an intelligent decision, you might lose out. But the point is, you went into it with a reasonable approach. Now, what's a fantasy approach? Fantasy approach would be, say you don't care about pensions at all, so that never even enters your head. That's not a factor in your, and you just say, you know, I watched a war movie and you know, I want to be a hero. I want all the girls, you know, singing songs to me. So, yeah, I'm going to go off and fight the war. You know, that's a fantasy approach. You might be a nice person. You might be a good person. But I would call that a fantasy approach to risk, to the risk of war. You know, if that person were my friend, I'd say, you need to think this over more. This is, you know, maybe you want to go fight for your country. That's not a fantasy. That's a healthy thing. Maybe that's what life is for you. You feel that you want to be a man and somebody has to fight. God knows. We need soldiers defending us. So it's not, if you do it knowing what you're doing and you've balanced the pros and cons, I think that's healthy and reasonable and good. But if you do it because you've got this fantasy image in your head that you're going to be a hero and this sort of thing, I don't think that's good. Now, in the investing realm, you know, this question of, you know, they'll say, there must be some downside to stocks because stocks provide such high returns. That's a statement you might hear from a buy and hold. I think that's a reasonable statement. There must be some downside. They can't be giving you 6.5 for nothing. So there's got to be some kind of risk there. That really does hit home with me. But then they'll say, stocks pay more because they're high risk, they're always best in the long term. This is what, you know, this is the Bernstein statement that I talked about, evidence-based investing backed up. That to me is fantasy. In other words, evidence-based investing was saying to me, stocks are more risky than other asset classes because he believes they pay higher returns. So he's obviously saying they're more risky, but then he's also saying out of the other side of his mouth, in other words, if stocks are really more risky, then why do we advocate them? Why don't we tell people stay away from them? You know, touching a stove is risky. Why don't we tell people don't buy stocks just like we tell people don't touch a stove? They say stocks are risky, and then they say go ahead and invest in them. Well, that's fantasy. In other words, either the risk means something, in which case you want to avoid it, or that risk is meaningless, in which case, you know, if risk is meaningless, it wouldn't increase your return. That both things can't be so. You know, if you said stocks are a riskier asset class, to some people they pay higher returns and to other people they pay lower returns, well, that would make sense. That would be a reasonable statement. Whether it's true or not, it would be a reasonable statement. But to say stocks are risky and therefore they pay high returns, but they're always best, that can't be. It's a conflict. It's a fantasy way of thinking about stocks, in my opinion. Now, the second dichotomy I wanted to point out is subjective risk versus objective risk. Subjectively, if you ask people, you know, are cars riskier than airplanes? Most people will say airplanes are riskier. Subjectively, they seem more risky because airplanes fly through the air, and that sure seems risky to us. In reality, I believe they say that airplanes are less risky on a numerical basis because probably because there's fewer of them in the sky, whereas cars, there's so darn many of them that if there were only a few cars, they wouldn't be risky at all. But there's so darn many of them, your chances of getting in an accident are pretty darn high. So objectively, cars are risky, not airplanes, or more risky. Now, subjectively, you could say, subjectively, a lot of people have two takes on stocks. Some people say stocks are always too risky. Some people just won't have anything to do with stocks. More of them all the time after this crash. And other people will say, stocks are never risky. I'm always going to be in stocks. Doesn't matter. You know, the fact that the promises the buy and holders make never come through, I'm just sticking with stocks. At least they say that. They may not do it, but they say it. Both of those positions are subjective opinions in my view. They're both emotional extremes. Stocks are always too risky. Stocks are never risky. Are never really risky. I think the objective statement is stocks are risky, but the risk can be managed by considering the circumstances in which you're investing. In other words, valuations. Consider the price you pay, and you can essentially eliminate 80% of the risk of stocks. Stocks have never done poorly for people who have invested them at times of a fair value or low price. They've always been an unmitigated disaster for those who have invested at high prices, like the prices that applied from 96 through 2008. So why not invest heavily in stocks when the risk is very small? And why not invest very little in stocks when the risk is sky high? In other words, why not consider how much risk you're taking on? It's not the investment class that's risky. It's the price that makes it risky when it is risky. So that to me is an objective approach to risk. Rather than subjective, saying I'm scared of stocks, that's subjective. Or saying I'm brave, I'm a buy and holder, oh yes, stocks for the long run. All this bragging, you know, that you hear the buy and holders, that to me is a subjective approach. Just the flip side of the coin of the person who buries his money in the yard. It's just two subjective approaches to investing. The objective approach is, yeah, there is risk to stocks. However, let me think. How can I avoid the risk? Oh, here, you know, if I buy at reasonable prices, I do well. If I buy at insane prices, I do poorly. I can manage my risk. That to me is an objective approach to investing. Now, there's particular risk versus universal risk. And the example I give here, that's an example. I don't know. The example I have is I tried to have something from the non-investing world, but this almost sounds like an investing question, although it wouldn't have to be investing. But I say somebody who has $100,000 loses $50,000, or somebody with $1 million losing $50,000. Well, there's a universal risk there. There's a universal risk losing $50,000. And everybody would agree it's a bad thing to lose $50,000. So a lot of times when they talk about all kinds of investments, not just stocks, could be housing or whatever it is, people will say, oh, you know, you lose $50,000, that's your risk. But you see, that's true. There's this universal element to risk. We can all lose money. But there's also a particular element. And the losing $50,000 doesn't mean the same thing to me that it means to you. Or the same thing to, you know, Bill Gates as it means for me. In other words, if you have $1 million, losing $50,000, it might just be a bad day. You're like, oh, what a drag. I lost $50,000. And then you go on about your business. Whereas if you only have $100,000 in, you know, life savings and you lose $50,000, I mean, you might be close to committing suicide. You lose $50,000. So we can never talk intelligently about risk without considering the particular circumstances of the person enduring this risk. There, you know, risk is not the same thing to different people. There's a universal element to the risk experience, and there's a particular customized element to it. And the example I gave, you know, particularly in the stock area was everybody who suffers a loss, say in a stock crash, is going to have a smaller portfolio for a certain number of years. So that's sort of a universal risk. But if you are in circumstances where you're 5 years from retirement or you're 5 years from when you wanted to buy a house, you needed the down payment for a house, or you're 5 years or 10 years from wanting to start a business and you lose that $50,000, well, you've suffered not just the loss of the $50,000, you know, not just a temporary diminished portfolio. You've lost a life opportunity that, you know, of consequence. And so if ever you're thinking about risk when it comes to investing, you need to factor that in. You can't just say, well, you know, I'm 35 and Bogle's got this rule about your stock allocation should be your age minus 100. So that comes to 65. I should be 65% in stocks. That's madness. If you're planning on buying a house at age 40, you might want to have 10% in stocks. Or if you're planning on starting a business at age 40, you might want to have 10% in stocks because you can't take on that particular risk. So risk has both a universal element and a particular element. Now, the fourth dichotomy I wanted to point out, compensated risk versus non-compensated risk. So I talked about in the non-investing world, I talked about going to law school as a compensated risk. Is there a risk in going to law school? There sure is. You're putting your money at risk. Costs a lot of money to go to law school. You're putting your time at risk. Takes a lot of time. You're putting your pride at risk. You might fail out and you'll be embarrassed. You'll be humiliated. You might hate it. You might not have a good time for 3 years. So there's risk there. But the nice thing is it's a compensated risk. If you go to law school and if you don't get kicked out and you get through, it may increase your earnings down the road. It may increase them dramatically. So there's a compensation for that risk. Now, how about smoking? Smoking is a risk. You might die sooner. You might die a lot sooner from smoking. So there's a real risk there. Now, you might not. Some people smoke. They live pretty advanced age. So it's a risk. But the question is that risk compensated? Now, some would say, well, the taste of the cigarettes compensates and for purposes of argument here, I'm saying that's not so. You're taking on a risk and there's really not much compensation. In other words, everyone knows smoking is risky in that you can die from it. But the reason people smoke, for the most part, I don't think is really the taste. It may have started that way. It's an addiction. In some cases, I do think there's taste and you know, it relaxes you and this sort of thing. I think it's fair to say that most people would agree there's not much compensation for taking on that risk, whereas going to law school is a very different sort of thing. You are definitely taking on a risk going to law school, but there is compensation. Well, in the stock world, say you invest in stocks at the prices that applied in 1982 when stocks were priced at one-half fair value. The most likely 10-year return annualized was 15% real per year. There's a risk. You're giving up your money. There was a lot of doom and gloom in the air. Whenever stocks are priced at half fair value, there's doom and gloom. So there's a risk. You know, there's always a risk. There's no such thing as stocks being risk-free. I believe that the risk can be greatly diminished, but there's always some risk. There's always a chance that the whole economy goes down and you'll never see your money again. So there's always some risk. But in 1982, you were being compensated for your risk. Now, how about investing in stocks in the year 2000? Prices were at a level where the most likely 10-year return on stocks was a negative number. Most likely. So every dollar you put into stocks meant not only were you giving up that dollar, you were lowering your wealth. The more money you put into stocks, the more you were lowering your wealth because you were likely going to suffer a negative return. In the long term. We didn't know in the short term. But in the long term, you were likely to suffer a loss. Well, that's risk that's not being compensated. So it's a very different kind of risk. So we can't just use one word to refer to both phenomenon. You know, the investor invested in stocks in 1982, I say, was doing a smart thing. The investor invested in stocks in January 2000 was not doing a terribly intelligent thing, in my opinion. The fifth dichotomy was singular versus multiple risk. In the non-investing world, I gave the example of a toaster stops working. Whenever you have a toaster, there's a risk. Might stop working, might break. But if it stops, it's not the end of the world. You go out and get a new toaster. Well, say we're talking about the risk of the wheels coming off your car. If the wheels come off your car, there's, of course, a risk there. Yes, you'd have to go and replace the wheels. There's a certain expense. But there's other risk. Another risk is, what if the wheels come off the car while you're going down the highway and your car, you know, just stops dead in the middle of the lane and you get smashed from behind and you get killed? Well, that's a much bigger risk than just having to buy a new wheel for the car. So there's multiple risk. In other words, some risk is singular and some risk is multiple. And this comes up again in the investing field. People will say, well, there's this risk, you know. Everybody sort of glibly says, you know, back in the days before the crash, they'd say, well, you know, yeah, there's a chance stocks could fall down, but it won't be that bad. I mean, I'll just hold and it'll come back. Well, all fine and good. But sometimes the risk of stocks is singular. Sometimes it's multiple. You know, people at the Bogleheads board would say, oh, there might be a 50% loss. Well, they miscalculate it. At the prices that applied from 96 through 2008, the odds were that the loss in stock prices were going to be a lot more than 50%. But say it was 50%. It wasn't necessarily just a single risk. There was a multiple risk. The multiple risk was you could have the drop in stock prices of 50% and at the same time have the economy go kerplooey. And at the same time lose your job. And at the same time have the value of your house fall in half. In other words, these different risks are connected. If you buy stocks at reasonable prices, you're only dealing with the risk of the stock. If you buy stocks at times of insanely high prices, a return to reasonable prices is going to cause an economic recession, which is going to put your job at risk, which is going to cause the housing market to crash. In other words, when we depend on bull markets to pump up our portfolio to insane levels, we're not taking on one risk, the risk of stock loss. We're taking on multiple risk. And that's a much more dangerous form of risk. So we can't just use the word risk to describe all these various phenomena. We have to sometimes spell out what kind of risk it is we're talking about. The sixth dichotomy, logical risk versus emotional risk. You know, one of the things, you need to ask this question of yourself. You know, what kind of risk am I worried about? Am I being logical or am I being emotional? If you say, in the non-investing world, if you say, well, if I don't meet this deadline, I might lose my job. I think that's a real risk. You know, when I had a job in the corporate world, you know, sometimes you'd be given, sometimes they were unreasonable deadlines. You know, you couldn't go home for dinner, you know, you had to stay all night. But the deal was, if I don't meet this deadline, it's important. You know, we've got a client on our back and we've got to satisfy that client. And if I don't do it, I might lose my job. That wasn't totally, that was sort of a logical understanding of risk. That wasn't totally an unfounded. You might not lose your job every time, but there was a risk there that if you didn't meet the standards that were expected of you, you really might lose your job. Now, other people would say, well, if I take a vacation, you know, I have a vacation time coming, but I'm not going to take it because if I take it, I'll lose my job. Well, I think that becomes emotional risk. In other words, if you get to a point where you're so afraid, you know, to take a week off that they're not going to keep you, you know, maybe you should be looking for another job. So I would call that emotional risk as opposed to logical risk. A logical risk is a risk where the fear you have really is related to job performance. So there's something sensible to it. It's emotional when you get to a point where you're literally living in fear. And that it's helpful to look at that dichotomy in thinking about what kind of risk you're willing to take on when it comes to your investments. A logical risk, say, of safe asset class, a certificates of deposit or a safe asset class, a logical risk is CD returns are too low for me to be able to rely on CDs alone to retire, you know, at age 65. CDs just don't pay a high enough return. I think that's a logical risk. I think it's a mistake to rule out investing in stocks. It's an emotional approach because that's illogical. What I'm saying here is it's a logical thing to reject that. It's emotional to say I'm not going to invest in stocks. It's logical to say, you know, CD returns are just too low. But I think it's emotional to say this is what the buy and holders do. They say CD returns can never match stocks. Stocks are always best for the long term. That's emotion. That's people who are saying, I don't care if stocks are three times fair value. Doesn't matter to me how high the price is. I have an emotional need to be told that I'm always doing the right thing investing in stocks. I don't even want to look at the numbers, Rob. I'm going to ban you. I don't want to hear what you have to say. I don't want to hear the historical data. I need to be told I'm always right. I can never make a mistake. That's an emotional need, not a logical need. That sort of argue, I put the word in quotes, argument is an emotional argument. So, that's not a logical analysis of risk. It's an emotional analysis of risk. All the stocks for the long run is an emotional claim. It's a marketing claim. It's not a logical, rational claim, in my opinion. Number seven, the seventh dichotomy, I have meaningful versus absurd takes on risk. I think I've made the point. You know, people can throw around the word risk and they can mix in, and this is commonly done in defenses of buy and hold. They often put forward half truths. They mix statements that really do have meaningful components in them. This is the evil of buy and hold in my mind. So many of the claims made in the buy and hold school or the buy and hold philosophy, the buy and hold approach, the buy and hold model, so many of them are rooted in some kind of insight that is real. And they win credibility through that. But then when you examine them closely, they don't add up. And that's when the buy and holders become angry. If you start asking, penetrating questions, they don't want to hear those questions because they have an emotional need to believe these things. Many of the beliefs on the surface sound plausible, but they're rooted in an emotional need rather than in logic or human reason. And the last of the eight dichotomies was the distinction between voluntary risk and unavoidable risk. And I, in the non-investing realm here, I give the example of joining the army, where you take on you voluntarily take on risk, or becoming a policeman. You're taking on risk, but you know you're doing it. You're doing it as a matter of choice. Or driving a race car, and unavoidable, death through nuclear weapons. There's clearly we're all at risk of being killed in a nuclear war. But we don't choose that risk. It's forced upon us. There's really nothing we can do about it. I see that as the distinction that applies in this decision of, do you want to pick stocks or do you want to just invest in index funds? If you pick stocks, I believe you can get higher returns than what you'll get in index funds. I believe that. John Bogle doesn't, but I do. I think picking stocks can work very well, but I think it's riskier. Picking stocks, they're probably 10% of the population has the skills needed to pick stocks effectively. So I think Bogle has done something very good in persuading lots of people that they should not be picking stocks, that they're, a lot of people think they can pick stocks and they really can't. In other words, if you took a poll, a lot of people would say, oh, I can do it. But if you tested them, they can't. And so they're better not to try. They're better to invest in index funds. That part I agree with Bogle. So I'm not in favor of picking stocks or in favor. I'm more in favor of indexing. I think most investors should be invested in indexes. But I think it's not a bad idea to try picking stocks and find out how good you are with a small percentage of your portfolio. And that helps you learn about stocks, which will help you even as an indexer. So I don't at all have any opposition to it. But, I think the stock picker can get a higher return, but I do think he's taking on more risk because he's got more variables that are uncertain. The indexer really only has one variable. Is the U.S. economy going to continue to be sufficiently productive to generate a 6.5% real return? If that happens, the indexer's in. He gets his return. He's set. Whereas the stock picker, he has a lot of variables at play. The management the management team that he thought was good has to stay in place, and the industry has to not become outdated, and all these other things have to work out for him. So he is taking on more risk, but he's taking it on voluntarily. Now the risk that the indexer takes on isn't a voluntary. The indexer does have risk. There's always a chance that the whole U.S. economy could go under, and none of us you know, all of us lose our investments. But that's a risk that can't be avoided. So I don't talk about that risk very much. What I often talk about in the podcast is how to avoid risk. But that risk you can't avoid. So why talk about it? It's a non-voluntary risk. It's an unavoidable risk. So those are eight dichotomies, different types of risk. And the answer is risk is not one thing. But the understanding of risk that the buy and holders put forward, I think, is a dangerous understanding, because I do think they make some important points. They've got some important insights, and we need to build on it and make this model a model that works in the real world. But the suggestion that risk is what brings return, that's the danger. Because when you start thinking about it that way, you close your eyes to risk. You start saying, you know, if you really buy into this buy and hold mantra that risk is always correlated with return, well, everybody wants a high return, so everybody should want high risk. And so therefore, you're not going to try to avoid risk. And that is investing suicide. You should always be trying to avoid risk. You know, this is a way in which, you know, my two heroes, Warren Buffett and John Bogle, are opposites. Warren Buffett is the smartest investor in the world, and he devotes all his mental energies to avoiding risk. I mean, ask him. He'll tell you that. It's all about avoiding risk. It's all about having what they call a margin of safety. It's all a risk diminishment exercise. And Bogle, frankly, throws caution to the wind. He avoids the risk of stock picking, which I think makes sense for 90% of investors. But he throws himself totally open to be blindsided by the risk of overvaluation. He tells people they don't have to change their allocations at all in response to overvaluations. He says they can if they want, but he says he doesn't know how to do it, and he doesn't recommend it. And the result is lots of people aren't doing it, and they're getting killed because they're taking on levels of risk a multiple of what they intended to take on. People who intended to take on, say, a 5 level of risk on a scale of 1 to 10, they were taking on a 5 back when stocks were priced reasonably in the 1980s, and by the late 1990s, they were taking on a 9.999 level of risk, and their portfolios, the risk was so much higher than what they were able to handle that there was no chance they were going to survive the inevitable crash. And they're losing money today, and they're being hurt in very, very serious ways. So we need to, you know, is anything I said in this podcast complicated? Is anything I said in this podcast really hard to understand? All of the examples were just things pulled from everyday life. I wouldn't call this stuff hard to understand. It's pretty darn basic. But you just need to, you know, take a little bit of time and talk through it and tease out the pros and cons. And of course, you always end up in the same place. You always end up in the same place, which is, in my view, is that you've got to invest in stocks or you're going to be delaying your retirement by many years. But you've got to take valuations into consideration because that's the biggest risk of stock investing. And so you've got to do that. And you don't have to get it precisely right. You know, there's some mathematical formula that would tell you should have a, you know, 60% stock allocation and you go with 50 instead of 60. That's not going to hurt you that much. You'll be fine. But if you go with buy and hold, you're going to be going with an 80% allocation when you should be at 20. And you're going to be going to go with a 20 allocation when you should be at 80. You're going to get it wildly wrong, not a little wrong. So that's real risk. Buy and hold is a blind approach to investing. It's a know nothing, see nothing, hear nothing approach. And I can't go for that, not with my retirement money. So you got to have an open-minded approach to risk. You got to be thinking about risk. I can't tell you everything there is to know about risk. But I think I gave you some things to get you started thinking about it yourself. And as you go through life's journey, you'll come up with things on your own. You'll have experiences and you'll fit the pieces of the puzzle in and you'll learn more. But the problem with buy and hold is that you adopt these rigid dogmas. You know, that risk is always correlated with return and you better not try to avoid risk because otherwise you'll never have enough return. And no. You know, the way they talk about it is, you know, if there's some risk you take on, well, you had to take it on because, you know, they've got this whole thing, what do they call it? There's no such thing as a free lunch. If there were a way to avoid risk, somebody would have already done it. So you can't do it. And that is idiotic. Any kind of risk you come across in life, there's a way to avoid it. I mean, getting married is a risk. But there are ways you can't avoid it. Every one of us that gets married has a fear in the back of our minds. So, you know, what if it fails? Every one of us has the fear. Thank God some of us haven't experienced it, but every one of us has the fear. But there are things you can do to diminish it. You know, you can obviously try to understand your spouse. You can act in a loving way. You check your temper. You know, in those delicate moments, there are things you can do. You try to marry somebody compatible. There are things you can do. So all of life is in so many areas of life. Life is risk. So in so many areas, it's about managing risk. And the thing that I can't stand about buy and hold is this cover your eyes and just say, oh, you know, there's got to be risk. So the dogma says I can't analyze it. I just have to, you know, stick with that allocation. Sure, it seems crazy. Doesn't make any sense. But stocks for the long run, buy and hold, stay the course, timing never works, you know. Repeat some magic phrase and somehow it's all going to work out okay. I don't think so. I think we need to open up our minds to the idea of talking about risk and thereby over time coming to understand risk. Good luck with your investing strategies.